Hey there, y'all. We'll get to that episode that you pressed play on in just a second, but I wanted to make sure you knew that the club is opening again for new members next Tuesday, April 30th. The club is a virtual community of parents of kids with big, baffling behaviors and vulnerable nervous systems, and you can read all about it over at robingoble.com/the club. If you already get emails from me, you'll get a message on the 30th reminding you that the club is open. Otherwise, set yourself a calendar reminder to go to robingoble.com/the club next Tuesday, the 30th. Alrighty, let's get to that show you're waiting for.
Hey there. If you listened to part one of this two-part podcast episode last week, you already know that I made a super last-minute decision to pause recording new podcast episodes during the month of July. I had a moment where I realized I really just needed to pause and rest, especially after last month's attachment series. So I reached out to a few podcasts where I'd been a guest and asked if I could publish the interview I did on their podcast on my podcast. And that's what you're going to get to hear today. Karen Buckwalter and her team over at the Attachment Theory in Action podcast graciously agreed. And today you're going to hear part two of a two-part interview that I did with Karen earlier this year, where we explored how I use relational neurosciences as the foundation for everything I do at work, on this podcast, in the club, and in my personal life with my friends and family. I'm Robin Goble, and welcome to the Parenting After Trauma podcast, where I take the science of being relationally, socially, and behaviorally human and translate that for parents of kids who've experienced trauma. I'm a psychotherapist with over 15 years of experience working with kids who have experienced trauma and their families. I'm also a self-diagnosed brain geek and relationship freak. Do you guys hear the roosters? I don't know if you're going to catch them on the recording, but the roosters are really cock-a-doodle-dooing right now. Okay. What I was saying is that I'm a self-diagnosed brain geek and relationship freak. I study the brain kind of obsessively and even teach the science of interpersonal neurobiology in a certificate program. I started this podcast on a whim with the intention to get free, accessible support to you as fast as possible. So the podcast isn't fancy and I do very little editing. You'll even hear a cock-a-doodle-doo in the background, which you probably already have and may even be hearing it currently. If you love this episode, add Parenting After Trauma to your favorite podcast player and share with your friends and colleagues. You're definitely going to want to head over to my website and get the free ebook I've created all about the brilliance of attachment. I took everything from a six-part series and had it professionally laid out into this free ebook. Watching the series go from words that I wrote into what feels like a work of art was surprisingly lovely. I hope you'll love it. robingoble.com/ebook. While you're on my website, you're definitely going to want to check out The Club, a virtual community of connection, co-regulation, and of course, a little education for parents of kids impacted by trauma. Earlier this month, I released a brand new feature in The Club. All of The Club content, masterclasses, Q&As, guest presenters, everything that happens in The Club on live video now has the audio uploaded into a private podcast just for Club members. So Club members get to listen to everything that happens in the club on a podcast app, just like you're listening to this podcast right now. This has been a huge hit. The club opens for new members approximately every 3 months, and we'll be opening our doors and welcoming new members again in the fall of 2021. If you head over to robingoble.com/the club, you'll be able to add yourself to the waiting list. In addition to the ebook I already mentioned, and of course this podcast, I have so many free resources for you on my website, including a free video series on what behavior really is and how to change it. I'll put the links to all these resources down in the show notes. Alrighty, so I hope you enjoy this flip-flopped podcast where I'm interviewed by Karen Buckwalter from the Attachment Theory in Action podcast. Now remember, this is part two of two. So if you missed part one that I released last week, you're going to want to go check that out. You might want to do it first, or you could probably just do it after. And then, of course, when you're finished listening to both parts, the next thing you'll want to do is add the attachment theory in action to your podcast player, because Karen has had some amazing guests, guests like Dan Siegel, Tina Payne Bryson. All right, y'all, here we go.
Hey, welcome back, everybody, to the Attachment Theory in Action podcast. This is part two with Robin Goble, and I am so excited to continue this conversation, Robin.
Me too. We're having a blast.
Yes, we are. Yeah. So, you know, we ended last week, you know, we were beginning to talk about neuroception and how we're constantly scanning for safety, for connection. And you were talking about this like big shift in your mind about this, but also this like puzzlement, like, okay, why would you be behaving this way if you really have connection?
Right.
And I wanted, before we get into that, I wanted to share something of my own experience of this big shift that I had about the idea of hypervigilance.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a term that, you know, we would talk about, you know, a lot with traumatized kids, and they're constantly scanning their environment and they're looking for safety, and basically their back brain's hijacking their cortex because they have to do that all the time and scanning. Is it safe? And I think what poor Jasiri did for me was like, wait. That's not just traumatized people.
Right.
That's like everybody, like all the time scanning, like I'm scanning, you're scanning, like people with less trauma are scanning. And I remember too, you know, like you said, you have these aha moments as you learn more. And I just remember thinking how normalizing that is.
Yeah. You know,
and that it's a continuum. And it's something we're all doing to various degrees, not anyway minimizing the trauma people have experienced. Yeah. But that was just like a really big shift for me.
Right.
That it's not just the severely traumatized person is hypervigilant, you know, and all these scanning. So anyway, I just wanted to share that. And as we move into thinking about, you know, how this shows up in the therapy room,
right?
And you know what we do about it, and how it shows up in ourselves,
right? Well, let's just go with hypervigilance since we're talking about it. So you're absolutely right, and people are always. I always get that question when I teach neuroception. At least four times every second, the brain is scanning for danger. People are always like, is that everybody or just the traumatized brain? Like, no, that's everybody.
Right.
And four times every second. I mean, Corgis has gone on to say, constantly, as opposed to four times every second. But I think four times every second is a more impressive thing to say. Like, there's this idea about every quarter of a second that feels wow, as opposed to constantly.
Yes.
I don't know. So that's not hypervigilance. That's the way our nervous system is designed to work. What then we feel as hypervigilance is when that four times every second is happening, and the child's brain, in the individual's brain, but we're talking specifically about children, is already at a heightened level of arousal and expecting something dangerous to happen next.
Yes.
That's where we get these behaviors people would maybe call as hypervigilance, and the, you know, the way the eyes are moving and the way that there's really already some energy in the arms and the legs, and it's hard to focus because they're pulling in all this information from the outside world in this more specific way. Well, what Porges has helped us understand is like that body and the brain is, and the nervous system is taking these shifts very intentionally to be able to pull in different kinds of noises and different sounds and, you know, these pieces that signal danger.
Right.
So now I can look at a behavior like hypervigilance and go, well, not only does that make perfect sense, but that also tells me a little bit about where this person is in their level of arousal. Like, what state are they in their nervous system?
Mm-hmm.
And when I understand that, then some of the other behaviors make more sense, because that's a behavior of somebody who believes they're in danger.
Right.
People who are in danger are controlling, are mm-hmm. sometimes manipulative, are mm-hmm. more prone to verbal and physical aggression. I know I am.
Yes. Yeah. And so it's almost like we have to think we have two things going on here. This scanning and searching for safety and all of that is a biological imperative.
Yep.
That, you know, we're all doing. We can even go back to attachment theory and the attachment system activated yep. by fear and danger and needing to
yep.
proximity to safety, all of that.
Yep. Yep.
But yet we're also needing to consider like level of arousal when mm-hmm. a person is doing that.
Yes.
Where that helps to explain these behaviors. Would that, right. is that a good way of putting that all together?
Yes. Yeah. So for me, I can take it out of any sort of like personalization and mm. look at like, oh, this is a sympathetically aroused nervous system that is neuroceiving a certain level of threat or danger. Mm. Okay. Mm. Now that's not personal. Now that's not about me. Now that's not about their character. Mm-hmm. Now that's not, you know, I can pull it out of all of those pejorative things mm-hmm. and think about it from a sense of, first of all, it helps it make sense when we understand the biological underpinnings of it. And that brings everybody regulation, usually, mm-hmm. The people involved. And then I feel like that helps me know what to do next. Yes. Right?
That's what we.
Yeah. I don't walk into working with a kid trying to decrease their level of arousal necessarily. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to shift their experience of safety so that their sympathetically aroused nervous system that's showing maybe us this behavior of hypervigilance or controlling behavior or manipulation or whatever, I want to see if I can offer to the best of my ability, knowing that there's a lot of things I can't control, cues of safety mm-hmm. and inviting their system into connection and safety. Mm-hmm. Because when we're experiencing connection and safety, we're not manipulative. We're not controlling. We're not defensive. You know, so these behaviors we're trying to help decrease, they shift naturally when the nervous system is experiencing cues of safety from the environment and from their internal world.
Right, right. And so as I'm thinking about this, and I don't even know how to phrase this, mm-hmm. but I'm thinking of this idea of rad kids and kids with rad, and you and I both have lots of problems with that diagnosis and that label, which we've both written about, so right. I know that we'll go into that here, yeah. But whenever I hear that, I hear it in a pejorative way, yeah. Like that particular awful, unhelpful diagnosis and label. Yeah. It's like, you know, this is when it's like the most horrible, terrible, worst of the worst behaviors, right. You know, early on being considered sociopathic,
these right.
little people. Right. So like what I love what you're talking about in terms of, it's just all not just because it's, as you said, it's problematic, mm-hmm. but it's a reaction of the nervous system. It's not some sort of manipulative, evil, like
yeah.
bad seed core or something.
It's not a character trait.
Oh, I love that.
It's a very reasonable response to what's happening in their brain based on like the way we experience every unfolding moment is that, for example, in this moment, like all the sensory data that's happening in this exact moment in my life is all coming into my brain and it mixes with 40 years of experiences, right? And that mixing of those two pieces together is what creates my subjective experience of reality and therefore creates like how I'm reacting in each unfolding moment.
Right.
When I have unmetabolized emotion, the past floods the present. And yeah. so even if I am, you know, in a place that other people would call safe.
Yes.
Because of the way my brain and the unmetabolized emotion is creating my reality, my experience is that I'm not safe.
Right.
And it's very reasonable for somebody who's not safe, especially relationally not safe. We're not just like talking about running from a burning fire, you know, like a house fire or something, but like relationally unsafe. It's very reasonable to use behavior strategies like manipulation, control, verbal aggression, physical aggression, opposition, defiance. Like they make perfect sense if we remember that ultimately we're just trying to stay alive.
Right.
Now, again, just like you said, just because they make perfect sense doesn't mean that we're just okay with them. They're not, you know, long. They're leaving the person stuck in a place of believing everything is unsafe.
Right.
That's a terrible way to exist in the world.
Right. So, Robin, you know, we've been talking a lot about the brain, about the nervous system, you know, getting more into how does that show up in therapy? How does that show up in the playroom? But if a child, you know, is living in a fear state, let's just say, talk to us a bit about what that is like for a child.
If you're listening to the Baffling Behavior Show as a therapist or some other kind of helping professional, I'll bet you've wondered how to incorporate owls, watchdogs, and possums directly into your work with kids. My colleague, Rose LaPierre, and I co-wrote a course together called All Behavior Makes Sense, Play Therapy with Kids with Vulnerable Nervous Systems. And Rose will be teaching it virtually in May. The course offers 6 CEs, including APT CEs, through the TheraPlay Institute. Part one of this course begins May 10th, so you have until then to register, but space is limited due to CE requirements, so I wouldn't delay registering if I was you. I'll put a live link down in the show notes, or just go to robingoble.com/TheraPlay2024.
The way of being in the world where you have this felt sense that everything is unsafe, everything is dangerous, is it really helps me to stay connected as much as possible to the truth of what a terrible tragedy it is to be constantly living in that space. Mm-hmm. Regardless of whether it seems accurate to me or not, right? Like regardless of whether I can look at a situation and say, this situation isn't dangerous. It's so clear the way this child is responding that their nervous system is experiencing an overwhelming, intense experience of life-threatening danger. Mm-hmm. It can feel frustrating to me. It can even feel personal to me. Sometimes like, hey, I'm not the one making you feel dangerous. And I know this feels so personal to parents at times, which is very normal, very human reaction, of course. And I have great compassion for that as well. But it seems vital to me as a therapist to honor that that's my experience, honor that that's the parent's experience, have a lot of compassion for how hard that is, and then shift back into remembering how tragic it is to be trapped in a nervous system of experiencing everything in life as dangerous, how exhausting it is, how it perpetuates itself, and how it's stealing from people this, what feels like this basic human right of felt safety and then the opportunity for connection and relationship.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm reminded as you're talking, something that some listeners may be familiar with, and I'm certain you are, is the Circle of Security shark music video, where you're showing a certain scene that, with calming music that looks, very serene and nice, and how that same exact scene, that same path, that same, trail, when they're playing that music from Jaws, it's like you feel like something's going to leap out behind, that's what, when I show that to an audience, they'll say, I feel like something's going to jump out at me. And I think about that, one image that often comes to my mind is kids walking through a hallway at school and, thinking that, it's just class is changing. I mean, no big deal. But when you think about shark music, and I will add, I know that video was originally made about parents hearing shark music, but I do think it's also really illustrates the point that you're making. Like, what is it like to walk through the world in that level of fear?
Yeah. And it's terribly, terribly sad. Like, the feeling that comes up for me is just this intense sadness of what then that person is missing out on. It's that sadness that then again kind of helps shift me out of normal human feelings of frustration or annoyance or like, come on, nothing's unsafe here, which again, very, very, very normal human reaction.
Yes.
It's, but it's not helpful in the moment when we're thinking about trying to help, shift this child's experience with safety.
Yeah. And I think, and we may have used this word earlier in the podcast, but this idea of presence in the therapy room and, being able to manage your own emotions that come up in the face of a child or a parent reacting to you that way. Let's look at our own nervous system and brain for a minute. Yeah. What do you have to say about that?
I have to say that I think it is the most important thing that we can spend time working on as therapists, that we spend a lot of time, rightfully so, gathering the latest tools and the latest techniques and all of the really cool things that are emerging from people's brilliantly creative minds about, what to do in the therapy room. And I have so much respect for that. And it's there, we need tools in our toolbox. And we, I think the most important thing for us to really study and pay attention to and give a lot of time and energy to is using ourselves as the kind of quote unquote or proverbial tool that felt safety and experiences of safety is the most important thing that's offered in the therapeutic experience. And there's a lot of things that play into a creation of felt safety and a client's ability to receive felt safety. But the number one thing is the state of our own nervous system, offering safety through our own embodied presence and being able to stay in a state of curiosity and compassion and willingness to follow the client wherever they're, wanting to bring us and completely honoring their experience of reality, regardless of whether that's our experience or not, and managing our own implicit worlds, our own unconscious things that we're bringing into the therapy room and working hard to come into awareness and contact of what those things are. And doing that work then allows us to show up with the level of presence that is the presence we're talking about when we say, our presence is the most important thing or the relationship's the most important thing in therapy, which I 1,000,000% agree. But I also think that it can be misinterpreted by very well-meaning therapists that all I have to do is like literally physically show up. Yes, you do have to literally physically show up, but that's not what...
That's the bare minimum of what you have to do.
Exactly.
Unfortunately.
Exactly. And cultivating that level of presence, especially when you work with the clients that you and I work with, right? The level of intensity and overwhelm that exists in the therapy room, cultivating that level of presence is a huge goal. Huge. Requires a ton of time, a ton of energy, a ton of, you know, real deliberate, thoughtful care and attention.
Yeah. And it can mean being in our own therapy. It can mean needing to find rituals that prepare us to enter into the therapy room. I personally think it definitely means seeing your sessions on video. Because it's difficult to know what's going on unconsciously without seeing it, without being able to step back outside. So, you know, I've had videos where I'm like, whoa, I really had that expression on my face. Whoa,
exactly.
I really did that with that tone. Like, that's not something I would have reported to the supervisor, you know? And it wasn't, it's not that I wouldn't have reported it because I was ashamed of it. Oh, it could be that. I mean, but a lot of times I wouldn't have brought it up in supervision because it's unconscious and I didn't know I was doing it.
Exactly. Exactly. It is so vulnerable and terrifying to watch yourself on video, but I completely agree with you that, you know, being brave enough to notice all of the nonverbal cues that we're giving our clients is very important.
Yeah, because generally, and I don't want to go too far off on this because it is a little soapbox of mine. So you know, there's a risk of it. But generally, what you're bringing up with your supervisor or someone you consult with is what's in your conscious mind. Right. Like, that's really all you can bring up.
Exactly.
So, you know, we could be missing this whole other piece. And I want to say too, and this is where I also have empathy for caregivers because I do, you know, I work with a lot of parents who are like, I've read the books and I've been to the I've gone to Empowered to Connect and I've, you know, I've done all of these things. And because I also use video intervention therapy and treatment and because I do in-home work, but you could also see this in a therapy session in an outpatient setting. Parents are often, and I own this as a therapist too, but they're often not doing what they think they're doing.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. So, all of us, so, just like you said.
Yeah. So, you know, we're trained in certain models and how you're supposed to do things. And what we're talking about here is you might think you're doing that, but you know, really you're not.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah, I love using video with parents too. Like I love showing them all the things they're doing so well.
Yes.
Because there's so many.
Yes.
And the same is true for us, right? Like we watch a video and okay, that's good. I like that part. And I think that's so important for parents. Like, look at all these amazing things.
Yes.
And also allowing them to discover moments where they can see how their child experienced them in a way that they weren't maybe intending.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So let's, you know, I always think that having a little bit of some kind of a case example in a discussion like this, you know, really makes it real. I think, you know, some of what we're talking about here makes it real right now in this segment. But I think, you know, sometimes we can get so caught up in all this brain science and polyvagal theory and what does Pank's upset, you know, all of, so like, maybe share a case example from, or, you know, a compilation, obviously you would to protect confidentiality, but like a kid that's really in a fear state and how you might have to handle that in the therapy room.
Yeah. The first thing that comes to mind when I think about, you know, a specific situation that comes to mind is how I work so hard to have enough regulation to have a moment of my own pause where I can go like, okay, what's happening for me right now?
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Being out of control.
Yes.
And then, you know, when I think when you work with kids, there's this extra layer of intense vulnerability of like, and their parents are watching.
Yes.
Hearing it from the waiting room or whatever. And so there's all these other things that like flood us as therapists. Right. And assuming we're not in a crisis state where I have to intervene in a way that provides safety.
Right.
I mean, we've not escalated to that, which does occasionally happen. I work really hard to call a moment of pause in myself. And that's IPNB driven. That isn't exactly a technique, but it's a technique all at the same time of like, okay, notice everything that's happening for me. Like I have to show the parent that I know how to handle this, or I have to be a good therapist and get this under control right away. Or I can't let this happen in my therapy room. Good therapists don't let this kind of stuff happen in their therapy room or whatever it is. And just be like, nope, all of that's for later, because none of those thoughts have anything to do with this child's experience with me in the here and now. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say I'm perfect at this by any stretch of the imagination, but you know, we're aiming for good enough here.
Right.
So then I try to put on this lens of what is this child doing? Because I believe everything is an attempt to move towards regulation.
Yes.
Everything has purpose. Everything is an attempt at finding coherence and organization. Oftentimes though, when those attempts are, you know, connected with the neurobiology of disorganization and complex trauma and all that kind of stuff, those attempts are these like almost futile attempts that are trying to find regulation organization, but not super successfully. So I try to look at like, what is this child doing? What's their body doing? Is this child throwing things? Is this child screaming? Is this child, you know, running? Are their legs moving? Are their arms moving? Is their body moving up and down? You know, I really try to look at what is literally happening, and is there a way I can connect with this child using that energy, using that movement, but also using my regulation that could bring that energy and that movement into some co-organization? Mm-hmm. Can I blow up bubbles that get a child to maybe blow the bubble back at me, or want to blow the bubbles themselves? Or can I toss a balloon towards them that almost always they're going to engage in their own experience with the balloon? Like maybe they start tossing the balloon sort of back and forth themselves, or they toss it to me. And then now I've got energy. There's still a lot of energy in the room, but it's starting to bring in some rhythm. It's starting to bring in some connection. It's starting to bring in some co-organization while staying in this heightened aroused state. Mm-hmm. So I can think of kid, you know, as kids like come barely, you know, the child that just like, no matter what you do to create structure and organization when you greet them in the waiting room, mm-hmm. just like blow past you anyway, and they're in your office before you can even get there.
Yes, yes.
And there's this, you know, and so I can picture this and think about how I would run after them, but not with the energy to catch them, with the energy to join them, to experience them. And so while my feet are moving in the same way, sort of regardless, there's a very different energetic experience, right? There isn't this frantic, ooh, I need to catch you. There's this, all right, here we are. You're running. I will join you. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to look for a game or an experience that attempts to engage the legs, that attempts to use that level of energy. And mm-hmm. once we're connected up, then I may attempt to sort of shift and down regulate. It's going to depend on mm-hmm. exactly what's happening in the moment, what my treatment goals are.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and as a therapist and trainer, of course, you know, yes. I'm running all of this through that framework and thinking about this is, and not just TheraPlay, This is the art of all therapy, that, you know, whether you're a therapy therapist and you had your session planned and then the kids really dysregulate, that all goes out the window. And now here's the art of therapy. Or even if you do some other form of play therapy, if you do child-centered or something like that. And we talked earlier in the podcast about, if it's still in there, since I know we had a little snafu, but, you know, training that you end the session when a kid gets really dysregulated. And I say, no, that's when it all starts, you know?
Exactly.
And you know, that's where we have to bring to bear ourselves and our own regulation. And this is where, when people think it's about, you know, therapy activities, it's not about therapy activities. Like they're just a means. They're just a tool we bring in, just as whatever kind of therapy you do, you bring these tools or techniques in. But without this that we're talking about, which is way harder, way you know, as we talked about earlier, if it was about tools and techniques, I'd be like set, you know?
I know. We are good students. We work hard. We master things. We are A+ people, Karen, me and you. Sometimes I just am like almost in hysteria over how I'm an A+ person. You give me a task and I will finish it. And I managed to land myself in a career where that is not possible.
I know.
No, let me do this right enough, right?
Yes.
So
gross. Yep. It's true, you know. All right. So, Robin, another thing that I know you're fond of saying, since I, you know, follow, you know, read your stuff and, you know, read your comments in groups we lurk in and or participate in. This idea that all parts are welcome. And I think that's just such a beautiful phrase. And I would like you to share what you mean by that in terms of, in the therapy room, all parts are welcome of, like, who, the child, the parent, you, like, just tell us what you mean by that.
I'm interrupting the show real quick because if you happen to be a new listener, you might find yourself being a little overwhelmed by all this information. That makes total sense. I mean, there's like 150 episodes plus all the free resources that are available over my website. It's just a lot. So many folks have asked me, where do I start? So I created a separate podcast stream called Start Here. What I did is I took the 10 episodes that I want you to listen to first, and then I want you to listen to in this specific order, and I put them into a separate podcast stream so that you don't have to search for them. You can just press play and they'll play one after the other after the other. If you go to robingoble.com/start here, you'll be able to get an invitation to subscribe, and then you'll be able to listen right in the same podcast app you're using right now. robingoble.com/start here.
When you gave the example of how some therapists are trained to end sessions when things go a certain way, that's the first thought that came into my mind just those, you know, 30 seconds ago, is how am I communicating to a client all parts of you are welcome here? If the moment they bring me their most hurting, most vulnerable, most protected parts of self, that usually are expressed in a way that's hard, right? If the moment those parts of self show up in the therapy room and I say, oh, you know, we're going to have to end our session for today, I don't know how we also invite all parts into the room. Mm-hmm. How can all parts come if the moment a certain part shows up, or if the moment a certain part shows up and we put a boundary on it, and we put a boundary on it a second time and a third time, and then the third's the magic number. And so now the session's over for the day. I feel the same way you do. Like, no, those are the exact moments we need to be in the therapy room.
Right. Because if that worked for this child, they wouldn't be there in absolutely. Our office.
Absolutely.
I'm sure somebody tried several warnings and then you know, something happens, you know.
I would say the exact same thing. Like, if that was going to work, they wouldn't even be there. And I also kind of put that through my adult lens and think about, like, what if that happened in my own therapy?
Right.
I had a therapist, like, sorry, we're going to have to end for today. Oh, you know, so when I say all parts are welcome, there's so much in that. I think that may be a phrase that's used in like the internal family systems model, which I want to be clear. Like, I'm not trained in that. I've done my parts work training with Bonnie Badenoch and her inner communities model, which has some definite similarities to internal family systems. And so implicit in all parts are welcome is this belief that no behavior is maladaptive. Every single thing that you do makes perfect sense for how you're experiencing the world in this exact moment. Mm-hmm. And a way that I convey that to the client is by welcoming in all parts of them, all behaviors, although while we're still acknowledging that I get to have my own boundaries too. Mm-hmm. There's absolutely behaviors that aren't acceptable. It's not okay for me to get kicked.
Right.
It's not okay for me to get spit on. But the part of you that holds that level of terror where kicking and spitting emerge, that part of you gets to come into the therapy room, and we're going to figure out another way for that part of you to express that part self without anybody also getting hurt.
Beautiful. That's so beautiful, Robin.
I wouldn't say I do that perfectly by any stretch of the imagination, by any stretch, but it is always my goal. And I believe my clients know that that's my goal. Somewhat because I'm very explicit at times and being clear about all parts of you get to come here and remember this amazingly precious child who would scream, I hate you. You're the worst therapist. I wish you would die. Really hard things that are hard to regulate through. Sometimes being them at you. Mm-hmm. And at the end of every time we would part, I'd find a way to communicate to this little one, those parts of you get to come here too. Because there was a lot of shame that would come up around those parts. A lot of shame that would come up around having behaved that way.
Yes. All
those parts get to come here too. And me and you, we're going to figure this out. I want you to bring those parts here. I'm going to do what I have to do to be able to tolerate being screamed at that somebody wished I was dead. Mm-hmm. That work to tolerate that so that you can bring those parts here. And we're going to figure this out together, because the experience that's underneath screaming at somebody that you adore, and I know that this child adored me, that you wish they were dead, the terror and the agony and the despair that's underneath that is tragic. And it's my job to find a space of holding.
I'm thinking about, you know, earlier when we were talking about working with really dysregulated kids, and you know how that, you know, one of the things that's different than even dysregulated adults in general is the, you know, they just, based on their own history, based on their development, whatever, there aren't filters in the same way. So they can call you ugly, nasty, whatever, you know, it's easy to become triggered by that. I know from my interview with Bonnie Badenoch, she prefers touched and awakened rather than triggered.
Touched and awakened. I am touched and awakened when a child tells me how bad I smell.
Yes. Or how fat you are. Or how,
yes.
Your breath is so bad. Or
yes.
Yeah. Yes. So yeah. So yeah, but really that what you're talking about is just really, really beautiful. And being able to regulate ourselves and having, okay, so let's leap to, how about all parts of us being welcome? Like, how?
That's exactly what I was thinking too.
Yes. Yeah. So let's go there for a minute.
I have to welcome my parts that are touched and awakened when a client of any age, but you're right, the younger ones significantly less. I'm not sure I've ever had an adult client tell me how bad I smelled. Or these things. They might be thinking them, but they don't say them out loud. Children are happy to say anything.
Right.
You know? And so having, you know, a commitment to all parts are welcome, my client, it absolutely means I have to commit to that truth about myself too. That when I notice myself touched and awakened, I'm with those parts of myself in a caring and compassionate way.
Right.
And it might be, I notice you. I notice you're here, lovely part of self, and I will tend to you later when I'm tending to this precious little one who's with me right now, right? This human who's with me that I need to tend to. And coming back without shame of all the ways we're touched and awakened and in and out of the therapy room, all of my own experiences and my past have created everything about me and all these unfolding moments. And sometimes that means things and parts of self that I don't necessarily feel like super proud of, or I can feel very confused by, or, you know, and to shift into, okay, well, those parts get to come here too. And by here, I mean like in my own heart, in my own being, in my own way of being with myself. Mm-hmm. And when I do that work, when I get touched and awakened in a therapy room, it's way easier to notice it, notice without judgment, decide I'll come back to it later, return back to being with my client in the way that I really want to be with them, which is also in that all parts are welcome here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that, you know, as we're winding down here, you know, this may be one of the really most important key ideas here, is all parts welcome and self. And, you know, there is that cliche in therapy, you can't take your clients where you yourself can't go. And it's true, you know, and I think just part of my own journey is, if I can't accept less than perfection in myself, if I can't accept all of these things that I work on in myself, how, you know, can we really bring that level of acceptance to the kids? I mean, if they're doing something that you could never, ever accept in yourself.
Right.
Right. That's where this gets hard.
Yeah. And accepting something in yourself doesn't mean you're just okay with it always.
You're embracing it. Exactly. You're loving it. You're fine with it coming out anywhere.
Exactly. Accepting it in yourself is going, I understand, even if I don't understand, but I believe that part makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. And hold something that makes perfect sense. And I'm going to have compassion towards that self while also still acknowledging that there's times where that is a behavior, maybe that's hurtful towards myself or hurtful for others, and I want to keep working on it.
Right.
I like what you just said. Acceptance, and, you know, doesn't mean embracing.
Right.
Whatever. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Robin, this has been such a great conversation with you. I'm so grateful that you were willing to come on the Attachment Theory in Action podcast again. Well, goodbye for now. And again, always so wonderful to talk with you.
Thank you, Karen. It was just so fun.
Well, that was fun.
As always, thank you, thank you, thank you for taking the time to connect with me today and for caring for kids impacted by trauma. I am so, so, so grateful for you. Keep coming back and keep doing amazing work out there in the world. Please take a moment to share this podcast with your colleagues, friends, grandparents, teachers, everyone. The sooner the whole world understands the neurobiology of being relationally, socially, and behaviorally human, the sooner our kids will live in a world that sees them for who they really are. Completely amazing, sometimes, maybe a lot of the time, struggling. Thanks for tuning in today. I'll see you next time.
Are you ending this episode with maybe a big sigh of relief? Like, yes, finally, someone gets me and my kids. But also maybe a sense of like, okay, but now what? All right, y'all, I've got lots of possible now what's. If you want to connect with me directly, like pick my brain, have access to me almost every day, not to mention hundreds of other parents from around the world who totally get what it's like to be you, then you're going to want to join us in the club. We have monthly live events, including groups for siblings of dysregulated kids, a huge video library with something like 80 or 90 videos, plus transcripts and certificates of completion. Plus, of course, a very active forum that I'm participating in every single day. We open for new members periodically, so go check robingoble.com/the club. If we aren't open now, you can put yourself on the waiting list and I'll let you know the moment we open for new members. That's robingoble.com/the club. Now, if you're a professional and you want to strengthen your capacity to work with the families of kids with big baffling behaviors and vulnerable nervous systems, plus use all of my materials, including a 12-module course that follows raising kids with big baffling behaviors, plus be included in an online searchable directory so families all over the world could find you, then you're looking for Being With, which is my year-long immersive training program that runs January through December. So you'll want to go to robingoble.com/beingwith, read all about it, and if you're interested, put yourself on that waiting list too. Now, if you just maybe need a little extra connection and co-regulation, but don't feel like you need to join the club, then you can just keep listening to my podcast, or you could go subscribe to my Start Here podcast, and that'll give you 10 episodes in order that will take you through cultivating a great foundation of parenting with regulation, connection, and felt safety. That's at robingoble.com/start here. You have to go there. You can't just find it in your podcast app. Or you could get yourself a copy of Raising Kids with Big Baffling Behaviors, paper book, audio book, ebook. You can get that anywhere books are sold. Or you could just head to my website, download one of my very many free resources. I keep them all really easy to access at robingoble.com/free resources. Webinars, masterclasses, ebooks, infographics, all sorts of stuff. Go check it out. See what of those things could be supportive of you or maybe to the other adults in your life who are helping support you and your child. There are just so many ways that you and I could be more connected, and you can get the amount of co-regulation and support that you need. If it feels like a lot to remember, all you have to do is go to robingoble.com and take your time clicking around, seeing what I got there. I am so, so glad you and I are connected now, and I can't wait to be with you again soon in our next episode of the Baffling Behavior Show. Bye-bye, y'all.